This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet Plush Care, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello, and thank you very much for downloading the Scotland Outdoors podcast. I'm Mark Stephen, he's Ewan McElroy.
Yeah, I've had a great week. I've wanted to see this particular beastie for decades, and this week I finally got to see one. I won't tell you what it is yet, but stay tuned.
And I've been drinking a health-giving draught from the woods near Aberfeldy. Fantastic stuff. I'm already 7 feet tall.
Treasure that moment. It goes very well with gin.
Well, I think it might. I actually think it might. Now, it's incredible that here we are in the 21st century, and the fact that there are female farmers, prominent female farmers in Scotland, is still past remarkable, and yet it is so.
Yeah, and, Joyce Campbell was a real force in nature. She's stood up against the establishment to a certain extent in Scotland. She's a sheep farmer up in the northeast of Scotland. She's championed the rights of women in farming. She's a key member. The government set up a thing called the Women in Agriculture Task Force, and she's one of the co-chairs in it. But I wanted to dig a bit deeper and just get the background about what drives her.
My dad died when I was 20. He committed suicide, which was a really traumatic time. And I was the right age, and I had done agriculture, and I just fitted into place. And I've been there ever since. And it hasn't been an easy road, but you make it work. And actually, once I got about 10 years in, I actually probably then really thrived, because I was off survival mode and I was actually into a productive time in my life.
But you had a bit of an issue with your husband as well during that time.
Well, I changed husbands, yeah, which seems brutal, but you get one life, you need to be happy, and you need to make the most of your life. And I was coming to 30, and I was thinking, I don't know if I want the rest of my life just to be like this. And I know that's sad, but it was critical, and I looked at the balance sheet, and I knew I could pay him out at that stage, and in maybe so many more years' time, I wouldn't. And that sounds very brutal and very cold, but I'm in a much happier marriage now, and probably that is a good thing for both of us.
But you took a big hit on your single farm payment income.
Yep, and that was just life. And that just made me realise that there is more ways to work and to farm and to approach a business. And that is very key. And it changed my mindset into drilling it right down to the nuts and bolts and getting to the very bottom of it and actually working out what I need and what I have to do to get there.
And you changed the way you were farming. You changed your livestock regime.
Yeah, I would have cut out the passengers and I would have taken off the poor performing yows that weren't working hard enough. And I still would be really critical on them. So some yows that I have to help at lambing time or that haven't got enough milk or are not making a good job of producing the lambs, they are not viable. I'm having to put too much effort and time into them, and I probably need to go and do it again. And probably Brexit is a chance for me to go and do that and say, right, kill again, take out the bottom end again, and refocus on the really productive end and the ones that are producing lambs at a low cost, and because it's all about profitability at the end of the day.
You also got rid of your cattle. And for many farmers, I'm going to be critical here, there is a tendency to do it because this is the way I've always done it.
I had to actually sell everything down to the last spade and buy back what I needed to buy back at a farm sale on my own farm, but that's what I had to do, the process I had to do. I have actually got cattle again. I've put them up to 25. They're really key in managing my grass, and my farm couldn't do without them as a management tool. I'm not saying they're the most profitable part of my business. They only about 10% of my income comes from them, but they key to looking after the grass management and the also the biodiversity of my in-by ground. So when I have the cows out in the hill, what I love seeing is all the flies on their poo. And that is key, because then you get your birds, your swallows following them around. So you have to look at the whole thing.
So you've turned your life around, you've got a farm that's profitable again, and then you throw yourself into championing the cause of women and farming in general. What was the thinking behind that?
Right. I have a list in my office of things I have to do in my life, and I scare myself sometimes when I look at that list, because it's sometimes quite challenging things to do. I don't want to leave anything on the field when I die, and I want to give the best I can. And I totally understand how women in agriculture can be a prickly topic for men, but also for women. And it's fine if you're a woman and you're successful and everything's going fine and you can't see an issue that you're not on a board or you're making your own way. But sometimes it's easy for women that are successful to pull up the ladder behind them, because they're no longer special. And what I want to do is empower women to go and have that difficult conversations in farming businesses, that then actually can make that farming business much more profitable and much more successful going forward. It's a diversity. It's not putting women on boards for the sake of women. It's the diversity that different thinking brings to the table.
But it's a whole pile of work. You're travelling the country. You live at the end of the world, and you're coming down to Edinburgh, you're speaking to MPs, you're on loads of committees. I mean, that must be difficult just in terms of running a farm.
I'm on one committee, and they're very good.
But you're in lots of things all the time.
Yeah, but one committee, and really very key that's the one committee that I'm concentrating just now, and it's coming to an end game. When it was launched, we were given it a year and a half to 2 years. We are coming to the year and a half stage just now, coming up close to 2 years, and we are coming to the end game. We are about to launch pilots. The money, the funding is in place partly, so it's about knowing your farm business. It's about giving women and men the skills, a training up that they can actually go and match up training across the country. The continuous professional development that we need as an industry that has been sadly missing. I have never been on any training in my life until a year ago when I went to BBC Expert Women Training. That was my first training I had.
Are you seeing a change? I mean, you say you're launching this and hopefully successful, but you've inspired, I'm going to not spare your blushes here, you've inspired a lot of women to actually stand up and be counted. I've seen a change. Have you seen changes over the last 3 or 4 years?
I think there's more and more. I think social media takes it to the forefront, and you realise that there is great women all across the country, and you know what else? All across the world, doing a great thing. But maybe they don't shout about it as much as I do. So it's recognising, and people recognising in themselves and having that pride. So I think that's maybe the changes. And we are successful. We're going to be successful. We will support women and men. It's equality and fairness. It's nothing about making women go to the board. It's about making successful farming businesses in this country. And that is what the Women in Agricultural Task Force and the government are wanting.
Farmer Joyce Campbell there, and she's got some remarkable stories about committee meetings in the past.
Yeah, I've been told to go and make the tea, love.
Yeah.
And also,
because we're going to talk about the important stuff.
Well, actually, I asked the women to leave because we're getting on to the important business of the day.
Yeah.
Luckily, things are changing. Mm-hmm. Perhaps not quite as fast as everybody would like, but they are changing.
Edinburgh actually has more green spaces and parks than Glasgow, pro rata, despite
really?
The fact that, yes, this is controversial stuff, despite the fact that Glasgow is known as the dear green place.
Yes, it is.
It's got a lot of parks. The Seven Lochs Wetlands Park is Scotland's largest urban heritage and nature park. It's a biggie. It's about 17 square kilometres, something like that. It spreads through Glasgow, Easterhouse and Steps. Now, 4 years ago, I visited the Hogganfield area of the park, back, you know, when it was still in development. This time, I met up again with Scott Ferguson, project coordinator at the other end of the Seven Lochs Trail.
So we're just walking around beside the Crannog Plate area here at Drumpellier.
The play area was built just over a year ago, and the inspiration for it was the fact that right adjacent to where we've constructed it, we know there are the remains of an Iron Age crannog in the loch here.
How do you know that?
Well, the loch was drained for maintenance, thinking about the 1930s, and when the water was drained down, they discovered the remains of the crannog there. They carried out an archaeological investigation of it and found a range of different artefacts. The evidence of metalworking, two human skeletons were discovered. And I think we're hoping that we'll be able to get our hands on some of those finds. They are in storage in the museum service.
You know that for a fact?
We're hopeful that they're there. We're not absolutely certain. We haven't located them yet. Uh-huh. But you know, between Glasgow and North Lanarkshire, who are two of our main partners in the project, we hope we'll be able to get our hands on some of the finds from the archaeological investigation here. We've got fantastic heritage and history right adjacent to some of Glasgow's most populous areas.
Tell me about the Seven Locks Trail.
So the Seven Locks Trail links Drumpellier, where we are now, with Huggenfield Park in Glasgow. So Drumpellier is really our sort of most eastern gateway to the Seven Locks Wetland Park, and Huggenfield sits right on the western side of the park. And one of the first things we wanted to do was create a trail that linked those two, the two ends of the park. It's about a 10-kilometre walk or cycle, mostly along woodland paths, lochside paths. There are a couple of points where you have to come out onto the footway, but in general, it's an off-road route.
Given the fact that you're essentially in the outskirts of cities and towns and things like that, does that complicate the issue when you're trying to create a path? You know, would it be easier just in open countryside?
It can complicate the issue, I guess, because of the mix of land ownership we have here. There are a lot of areas on the edge of cities where obviously there's development interests, and they might not be so keen on having new paths put in where there's a hope that that land might be released for development. When the park was established, we knew right from the start that there were areas of the park where development was going to happen. And part of the rationale for the park was to try and work with development. So where development happens, our aspiration is to try and integrate that into the wetland, woodland environment that surrounds it.
You can hear black-headed gulls above us scuttling away.
Yeah.
There are a lot of birds on this loch.
Yeah, I mean, the Loch End Loch, it's got a nice path all the way around, very accessible. So it's a great place to come and see some of the wetland birds. Similar to Huggenfield Park, again, very easy to access, and it's very easy to get close to them. So we've got mute swan here. You can see a couple of coot. As you said, the black-headed gulls overhead. We had some goosander over by the visitor centre earlier. So a wide range of birds. And this time of year is when we're getting that changeover of the birds that you might see on the lochs. One of our more characteristic species is whipperswan. And Huggenfield Park is a place where you can get very close to whipperswan. Uh-huh. If you want to get photos of whipperswan, it's one of the best places to come.
They're not always that keen on it. I walked past a couple of mute swans earlier and got hissed at. You know, and I thought, I'm on the path, come on.
Yeah. Well, and I guess it's one of the things that people love to do here is come down and feed the birds. Now, we try not to encourage people to feed birds with too much bread and stuff like that. So we do have signs up that try and encourage people to think about what they're feeding the bread in and maybe go with something that's a bit better designed for our
grains,
our wildlife, grain, vegetables, etc.
Vegetables?
Yeah, carrots.
You can feed carrots to swans.
Yeah,
I didn't know.
They do like a bit of veg. I mean, they're entirely vegetarian, so you know, anything like that is fine. But lots of white bread or lots of bread is not so good for them. But because people come and feed them, they come very close. So you can practically get a wild whipperswan to eat the grain out your hand at times. So a great place to come and just learn about what's on your doorstep.
Just as we were walking around the corner there, one of the mute swans took off. And yet you forget how big these birds are. It's almost prehistoric. You know, it's kind of creaking its way across the surface of the loch, just about
absolutely
4 feet up.
The noise of the wings when you hear them coming over is fantastic as well.
Setting up a trail like this, the Seven Locks Trail is one thing. Getting people to use it is another. I mean, how good has the uptake been?
Well, we've got people counters along part of the route. So those are automatic monitors that log everybody as they go by. And we have seen a bit of an increase. We produced a trail leaflet, which is available in our visitor centres, which maps the route and encourages people to walk it. But again, with a trail like that, you're not necessarily expecting everybody to walk the full route. So it's just as important to have little loops along the way that people can use, you know, for a shorter walk, just for walking the dog. But that infrastructure's there, and that just encourages people to get out and use places like this.
Given the fact this is post-industrial, this entire central belt of Scotland, you can hear heavy work going on across there, etc. They're banging and crashing about with heavy machinery. But this is still, for local people, a touch of wilderness. It's a touch. It's a green space. It's a green lung.
Yeah, a fantastic wild space, really. The parks here are managed for both people and wildlife. So don't expect something too manicured. We want to try and encourage nature into these places. And one of the things that we're working on at the moment, we're trying to do more of, is working with families and schools. We've got a big programme of work with schools now, because I think it is important to try and get our children and young people out into places like this and getting them hands-on with nature. So that's a big part of the programme that we're delivering here.
Scott Ferguson there of the Seven Lochs Wetland Park.
It's quite a great, must be quite a lengthy walk now.
That park at Drumpelia is an interesting one because it is almost exactly a mile round about the outskirts. Okay. So you see lots of people that are walking for fitness and runners and things like that because it's handy. If you start at one point, you finish at the end point, you've done a mile.
All right. Constantly looking at their watches. What is that?
It's not like us, constantly looking at our watches and pecking.
Yes.
And trying to phone 999 for help. Anyway, I was in Perthshire earlier this week because this is actually quite time critical. There is a 3-week period every year when you can actually effectively milk a birch tree, get something called birch water out of it. You heard of this?
I've tried it and failed spectacularly. I maybe did it at the wrong time.
Quite possibly. Was it a bit resinous when you tried it?
Yeah.
Well, the fact that it only runs sort of slightly flavoured water for that 3-week period, the rest of the time it's probably not going to... It's either going to give you nothing or it will be sap.
Yeah,
but that's
sap,
which does kind of beg the question, why does it flush itself with water for a start? But that's a question for another day, potentially. Now, you may have tasted birch water in Baltic and Scandinavian countries, but a couple called Rob and Gabrielle Clamp are actually producing it in Scotland now.
We got into this after buying a bottle, a birch water in a health food shop, looked in the back of the label a year ago, this was, and got slightly narked when we saw that it was actually made in Finland. And the more we looked into it, the more we discovered all the birch water on the planet mainly comes from Finland, Ukraine, Belarus and Latvia.
Uh-huh.
And despite the prevalence of birch in Scotland, nothing coming out of this country. So, we leapt on the idea at that point.
You have devices attached to quite a few trees around about here. Just describe this to me. How does it work?
So basically what these are actually maple syrup tapping kits. Because nobody, generally speaking, commercially taps trees in Scotland or the UK, so we have to buy these from America. And effectively what is a little plastic tap, and then a bag with a hooking device where the sap flows into the bag straight from the tree.
Do you drill a hole in the tree first?
Yeah, a very small hole. Okay. It only goes in about 5 or 6 centimetres into the xylem of the tree where the sap's flowing in. We just collect, we take about 1 to 2% of the sap that the tree's actually taking up.
Gabrielle's taken the bag part of this, the collecting part of this off. But essentially, I mean, that's dripping at quite a regular rate.
Yes.
It doesn't drip like that all year round.
No, it's only for 3 weeks when the sap is rising up the trees. So basically, during the winter, the tree actually stock all the nutrients it will need in the ground. Mm-hmm. And as the temperature changes, the sap starts to rise and brings up all these nutrients up to the tree onto the leaves.
Okay, and what do you do? I mean, because effectively you've got a blue plastic bag. I would have said it's probably a couple of litres of liquid in there. How do you have to treat that in order to make it drinkable?
Well, what's interesting about birch sap, it will ferment within about 3 days. So we freeze it. We freeze it immediately, and then we defrost to order. To give it a bit of a shelf life, we gently pasteurise it a little bit. Some of the other international companies tend to sterilise their products, so it lasts for a year. But
okay.
So we're looking at alternative methods of preserving it naturally.
What is the advantage, the benefit, the joy of, what do you call it, Birchwater?
Birchwater.
Birchwater.
And that's the market name. It's called Birchwater because at this time of the year it's very mobile. It's moving up the tree almost like water, but it's not water. Obviously it ferments within about 3 days. It's packed full of vitamins, minerals, enzymes, antioxidants. It was traditionally used in the Highlands. It goes back about 5,000 years. People were using it as a spring tonic, actually, after a long winter. Newborn babies for cattle, for themselves.
What's your own background? I mean, you look like you should belong in a wood.
Yeah, thank you. I've been a forester all my working life. But what's interesting is, as a forester, you're trained in how to grow trees and manage trees. But we're on a real voyage of discovery at the moment because these sorts of things, the health benefits, the non-timber side of things, you don't generally learn as a forester. So for me, it's a journey of discovery, and Gabrielle as well.
Yeah, I was a chiropractor, and I've always been really interested in plant healing and natural ways of heal yourself, good eating, organic. So naturally, I've been drawn to this product because I kind of heard about it in France, where I was living before, and I knew it was really known over there.
How proven are the health benefits of this? I mean, people can make claims for stuff, but
absolutely
really.
No. We obviously have to be careful what we claim, but what we point to is all the research. Lots of research been done in Scandinavia, Finland, and Russia in particular, where it's had a very long history, and lots of research saying, you know, just talking more about the health claims and the science side of things. So we just point people towards that.
And what does it taste like?
Well,
thank you. This is a three-man effort.
Whoa, there you go.
Right, there you go. So this is literally
straight from the tree.
Right, okay. And it's birch water.
Yes.
That's a very interesting taste. Mm. It's quite a complex taste. It's not at all what I expected. No. I don't know what I thought it would be, sweet, slightly resinous, sappy.
A lot of people say that. They say, oh, I don't know what to expect. Well, actually, it's not what I was expecting, but different people get different things.
What we find is the texture is quite silky. I don't know if you're getting a silky texture to it. Almost like milk, but it's obviously not milk. And it has a little afternote of different sweetness, or perhaps some people get melons, some people get, you know, they get other things.
Well, I could see melon.
Cucumber, some people say.
Cucumber, yeah.
It's really subtle.
Hmm. That's very, very interesting. Very interesting.
But only for those 3 weeks. So after that, as you rightly said, it's more like sap after that.
Okay.
Yes.
And you can't drink it.
No.
You can't drink it?
No.
No. You go mad in the woods.
Indeed.
So, I mean, how long did it take that? Say it was a couple of litres in the bottom of that bag. How long did it take for the tree to produce that?
Depending on the tree and the weather can influence it. We tend to average about 5 litres every 24 hours per tree. So 5 litres a day. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Right. Some will give more or less.
And when you sell it on, how big, how small are the bottles?
250 millilitre bottles. Okay, we tend to sell them in. We're looking at having bigger bottles and a sparkling version, which actually...
Oh, now that's a good idea.
It's very nice. Yeah, the flavours really pop out with the sparkling one.
Yeah. I'm obviously approaching this entirely the wrong direction. I could see you mixing that with gin.
Yes.
Well,
exactly. Yes, really good.
It's really nice with gin. This one is really nice with whiskey as well.
Really?
Lovely with whiskey because it's silky and it takes the burn. You don't get the burn you often get with whiskey. This one, it also goes nice with gin, and the sparkling one especially.
Yes. Yeah. At that point, it's not really healthy though, but...
But it's a win-win.
Yeah, you can make exceptions. Yeah.
Well, in Russia, they have this win-win situation. You have, you know, vodka and birch water the night before, and then you have a hangover cure the next day. Actually a very good hangover cure because it's very complex, you know, and it hits the spot. So,
Absolutely fascinating. Absolutely. And what I like about it too is it's so low impact. I mean, if you take that wee spile thing out, you'd never know.
Well, you wouldn't. We just plug the hole back up again. Tree's absolutely fine. We go to a different tree next year, and the trees are absolutely fine.
Rob and Gabrielle Clamp with their Birkenwater, and I've actually got some of it here. Mine's sophisticated because I've got Birkenwater ice cube in it too. Made of the same stuff. What do you reckon?
I didn't say I was a fan. Slightly woody, sort of citrusy hint to it. It's very subtle.
I'm not picking up the citrus. I am. Things like a melon and cucumber, that resonate with me for that. But you look taller. It's like an Ent draft. Your hair will be growing back shortly.
Well, birch wine is traditionally a cure for baldness, and I can tell you honestly, it doesn't work.
You've drunk gallons of the stuff, doesn't work.
I've put it on my head. I've tried everything. It doesn't work at all. The other thing I was trying was beach buds. The leaves are out on my hedge. at the moment, and I tried some yesterday, and they got a lovely nutty taste. Uh-huh. And it was a television star Chris Packham actually introduced me to. So try them now. Don't try it later because you get full of tannins. Uh-huh. And I thought, because we broadcast in the Beech Grove Gardens,
and the clue's in the name,
they'd be out and we'd try them, but they're not out, so we'll have to wait another week to try that. But there's a lot of signs of spring around. I met up with Katrina Reid, and she's in charge of the Muir Dinnet Nature Reserve run by SNH up in the northeast. You've been there.
Yep, there's a geological phenomenon there called the Burn of Vat. Effectively, it's a cave with a collapsed roof. So if you imagine a bowl, and it's been scoured out by thousands of years of water, probably glacial water originally. But I would really like to see that in spate, because yeah. Apparently it just shoots out the mouth. There's a whole pile of boulders at the front of
it. You wouldn't want to be in it.
No, you couldn't be.
It would be like a washing machine.
Yeah, it would be bad.
Yeah. Anyway, Katrina was writing in her blog this week that the aspen trees have produced catkins for the first time in decades. So we're up for a wee look.
We are looking out over Loch Kinnord. There's two lochs in the reserve. This is the larger of the two. And Loch Kinnord's a great place for the breeding birds. It's quite choppy just now, so it's hard to see stuff, but it's one of the best places to see breeding goldeneye away from Strathspey. It's the biggest population outside Strathspey.
And we're sitting on these very cute, well, what would you call them?
I just call them perch seats, because you don't really totally sit on them. You just kind of park your bomb,
I would say.
It's
like a very exotic shooting stick.
Yeah, so you just sit and lean on them. So it's a nice place to have a bit of a lean and look out over, especially when there's a little bit of warmth in the sun, as there is.
It's just starting, isn't it? Still getting occasional snow, occasional rain, but every now and again when the clouds part, you get a real searing sense of warmth.
Mm-hmm. It's really starting to feel like spring.
Well, let's take a wee wander, because we're actually not here to sit and look out over the lake, although pleasant as that may be. We're here to talk about aspens. Mm-hmm. It's a fascinating tree, isn't it?
It is. They're quite widespread in Scotland in individuals, but in terms of actual aspen woods, that's very uncommon. I think in terms of aspen woods, there's fewer than 30 in Scotland.
Why was that? They just chopped down, destructed?
Partly. I mean, Scotland was hugely deforested, obviously, over the years, but aspen are probably one of the favourite things of all the browsers and munchers of trees. Deer, rabbits, and more recently beavers will take aspen more or less in preference to anything. So where you see aspen flushes, like here, they're often post-war when rabbits were heavily taken for the pot.
So they've managed to get away?
So they managed to get away during the war when the rabbits were really knocked back because people were getting extra sources of meat by taking them.
Any reason why an aspen should be such a juicy morsel?
I am not 100% sure, but I would guess it's got a very high nutritional content. Maybe it just tastes good. Maybe it's just something as simple as that. I don't know what rabbit's taste buds are like, but all the browsers seem to favour aspen.
Now, I don't know much about aspen, but I do know they are fascinating from a biological point of view.
They are, yes. Aspen tend to reproduce what's termed asexually. So genetically, they all are the same, and they tend to form clones off of one another. An aspen tree has got roots, you know, every tree's got roots, but off the roots you'll get a little sucker, a shoot coming up that can grow into an independent tree itself. And that independent tree can then produce roots and produce more suckers and so on and so forth. So you can look at an aspen wood, and the whole wood might actually genetically only be one tree.
Even so we've got a whole line of aspen here, they're all possibly the one tree.
Genetically, yep. Yeah, quite likely. But that doesn't matter, aspen's quite happy like that. It's not bothered.
There's also stories in the States of massive forests that could just be the one plant.
Yeah, there's one in Utah called the Pando Aspen, and it covers over 40 hectares. It's got about 43,000 trees in this wood, and they think genetically it could all be the same aspen tree. Nobody's quite sure how old the genetic stock is, the root stock is, but it could be between 80,000 and 1,000,000 years old. That doesn't mean any one tree is that old, but the genetic stock it started from could be that old.
So these could be pretty old as well, then?
Some of these could be pretty old. This is one of the older ones here. It's not as straight as some of them. The younger ones have often got very, very straight, elegant form. This one's a bit more gnarled and twisted, and probably a lot more interesting to look at in some respects.
But you get male and female ones, don't you?
You do, yes, you do. Now, quite unusually, I can actually tell this is a male aspen tree. Normally, you can't tell by looking, but if you have a look here, you'll see it's produced catkins this year.
Loads of catkins?
Loads of catkins. Now, they probably look a bit like a cat's tail, and they're about as long as my middle finger, sort of fluffy, dangling catkins. Those are the male catkins of the aspen. I haven't found any female catkins yet here at Dinnet.
Okay, what's the difference?
The female ones would generally be shorter and come out a bit straighter, so they'd probably grow... and we're on the radio, you can't see this, but I'm holding this out straight from the branch to show you. So they tend to stick out more horizontally rather than dangle. Large, hairy and dangly equals male. There's a lot of things you could say right now, but we shan't, but it's a good way to remember it.
Skipping on, that must make them really hard to breed then.
Aspen are notoriously hard to breed. In terms of getting genetic diversity in an aspen population, finding female trees that are producing seeds is very difficult. And it's one of the reasons that when they do flower like this, everybody's always on the lookout to see if they can find female trees that could produce seeds. So this can be collected and put into native woodland stocks so that we've got, you know, more genetic diversity in the aspen and they can be propagated further on.
I suppose if they use the roots, they're not really that bothered about it.
In terms of the aspen being quite happy about it, they'll get on with it just fine, and the genetic diversity for the most part doesn't matter to them. When it would matter would be if some sort of disease got into the aspen that could attack a particular individual, that could maybe wipe out a wood that would be vulnerable to that, because you've not got different genetic diversity in the population which helps things withstand disease or attack by...
Now, the reason I'm here is I was reading your blog and you were saying you haven't seen catkins, you haven't seen flowers for a fair number of years.
No, I mean, I've never seen the trees in catkin here at Dinnet, and I've been here 13 years. But apparently the last time aspen actually produced these many catkins, sort of Scotland-wide, because they're doing it all over Scotland, not just here, was in 1996. But in 1995, we had a really, really long hot summer.
So it might be stress then?
So it could be a drought stress. It could just be they like the heat. They tend to produce catkins a lot more on the continent, where you get hotter summers anyway, and generally colder, drier winters. So maybe the climate in Scotland's actually a bit too temperate for them. It's not, you know, it's not pushing them to diversify, because they don't need to do most of the
theory
time.
Is if they're under stress or under threat, they have to get seed to actually survive
and spread, because the seed will... it blow and spread rather than the roots, which can only spread within the area of the root round about the tree. But it is really unusual. I mean, this is, 23 years ago the aspen in Scotland really did something like this? I mean, what were you doing 23 years ago? What was I doing? I was at uni.
I was holding the microphone talking about catkins.
You know, it sets you quite a long way back. It is really unusual for these things to do this. And if you ever look closer at these ones, you could actually see, if you pull the branch down, you can see the red bits in underneath.
You've got a lovely kind of pinky red.
That's the anthers, the sort of male flowering part, if you like, of the catkin, and that's a bit produces the pollen in there. And like all catkins, you're seeing some of the birds feeding on them. You'll see the redpoll feeding on likes of birch catkins over the winter, but recently I've been seeing the siskins getting on these, so they're obviously picking the protein-rich anthers.
Oh, a good year for them as well.
Yeah, well, there seem to be good numbers of siskins just now, yeah.
Catherine and I read at the Muir of Dinnet, and we'll come back to her a bit later on in this podcast.
Yeah, it was a fascinating wee chat, but it got even more fascinating, as you'll find out, a wee bit later in the programme. But we'll also look at some of the mythology and the folklore of aspen. It is truly amazing.
Dotted down predominantly the east coast, in the north two places of Scotland, you get Pictish carved stones. Now, some of them have beasts on them, some of them have religious symbols, some of them have mythological figures or designs, you name it, but there are at least three or four that show warriors, you know, a single warrior. There's Rainy Man, Khaleesi Man, and most recently Tulloch Man, which has just arrived at Perth Museum. I got a sneak preview with Mark Hall, Collections Officer at Perth Museum and Art Gallery.
Well, we have a couple of metres of massive standing stone-like slab, which probably arrived on the outskirts of Perth on the front of a glacier and was left there as the glacier retreated. And then probably erected in the Bronze Age as a standing stone is a good bet. And then in the Pictish period, early in the Pictish period, it is given this finely incised carving of a warrior figure.
You can see fairly clearly a pair of legs and what might be a club or something of the kind, and rather a large bum.
you know, but it's not that easy to... Oh, we're on the head here. I can see the eye now.
Here's the head.
You can see the hair.
Yeah, and you can see it's got what looks like... At first, we wondered whether it was helmet, but we're going with a distinctive hairstyle. We know from continental sources in the first part of the first millennium AD that warriors had distinctive hairstyles, which helped with intimidation. And you're right to suggest that maybe something here. You can see something. It could be a club, it could be a sword. But then here, you can see that shape there. That's what's known as a doorknob butt. So that's the bottom, the base of the spear. And then there's a fine line going up there. There's his hand holding it. And then it comes up here to the spearhead.
Where was this found, Mark?
It was found just behind where St Johnstone's football stadium is in Perth, between it and the crematorium, during landscaping works for that phase of the new road that's gone through there as they were tidying up. The two guys were charged with clearing away debris for where this final path was going through, and there's a lot of glacial till there. They were moving boulders, mostly small stuff. They found this really big piece of stone, which they knew they'd have to shift by a machine. They shifted it, and just on a whim, really, they said, well, shall we flip it? Uh-huh. Let's flip it over and see.
With a digger?
Yeah, yeah. Which is why we have some of these kind of scratch marks there that don't actually damage the figure. So they flipped it, and of course they could see there was something there, and the protocols that we're working under said, if any material conditions change from what we've told you to expect, stop work immediately and report it. Uh-huh. So they did.
So this has already been dubbed Tulloch Man. How exciting is it to actually come across one of these figures fresh? I mean, fresh from the field, literally.
Well, for me, it certainly is massively exciting, partly because of the completeness of it. It's in really nice condition. There is a little bit of wear on the upper body and the face. And in fact, there are only three other examples of this kind of figure, all scattered up the East Coast. There's one from Khaleesi in Fife, there's one from Rhynie, Aberdeenshire, and there's one from Westerton in Angus. And this is, in some respects, the best of the group in terms of what it gives us. So it's really, really exciting. I'm so happy.
I have seen Khaleesi Man years ago. I'm trying to remember the woman's name, Mariana Lines.
That's it, yeah.
And she does artwork based on it, and she does effectively stone rubbings using natural material and linen.
Yeah.
And she put this covering on Khaleesi Man, and the hairs went up in the back of my neck.
Yeah.
It was strange. It was almost like a grave shroud.
Yeah.
You're seeing something that's how many hundreds of years old? 1,500 years old?
Easily, yeah. We're talking probably, I don't know, 400, 500 AD.
When something like this is found, does this count as treasure? What is it?
It does indeed count as treasure trove. So this stone has just gone through the Scottish treasure trove process. So it's been allocated to Perth Museum and Art Gallery. And so what will happen to it next is that over the next couple of years, further research will take place. It'll be cleaned and it'll be mounted as one of the fantastic new exhibits to go into the new museum that's being developed for Perth. So people will get a chance to get up close and personal with it, you know, very soon.
Just when we were standing, you mentioned the fact you can see the spear, you can see the sort of ball shape at the end. I can see a triangle carved there.
Yeah, that's right. That's the top of what's called the doorknob.
Okay.
So if you imagine an old-fashioned rounded doorknob, so that's the bit you'd hold, and then that's the bit that sort of
flushes onto the door.
Goes onto the door, yeah. So we know from Roman authorities that some of these may have contained dried nuts and things so that they could shake, and that would be an intimidating noise as the legion was about to engage in battle. Like a rattle, yeah. But of course, it would also serve as a weight, so that it's a well-balanced spear that's probably going to be used for fighting on foot rather than on horse. But they had a whole range of spears for different combat situations.
And do we know the significance of this? I mean, who is this figure? Is he a guard? Is he a warning? Is he a representation of somebody?
He probably certainly had a warning or guarding role, if you like. He may not necessarily be a particular individual, but he may reflect the warrior ethos that was around at that time, with war bands, which eventually become kingships as the kingdom of Pictland develops. So one can imagine him outside either the entrance to a cemetery where somebody important is buried, or the entrance to a hall where somebody powerful lived, saying, you know, we are protecting the king figure or the prince figure, you know, in our role as warriors, and so just watch out. Can I read you a bit of poetry?
Oh, crack on.
This is from the Gododdin, which reflects warrior aristocracies in the north of Britain at about the time this sculpture could have been carved. No man's horse could overtake Marchlew. He would plant spears in a conflict from a leaping, wide-raging steed. He would plant ashen spears from his hand's clutch atop his steaming trim roan. So Marchlew made the blood gush forth. Whoever he'd strike was not struck again. Sharp-pointed his spears, shield in pieces, he bore through the warrior hosts. Speedy his steeds, front-runners. On the day of battle, his blades were deadly when Kynan would charge in the green of dawn.
That's a great series of images.
Yeah.
And you think this is a representation of that warrior?
This is part of that same ethos.
Yeah.
About the importance of the warrior at the top of the social hierarchy at that time in northern Britain, as indeed in most of Europe.
Yeah, armed, dangerous, and addicted to hair products.
Yes, absolutely.
Mark Hall from Perth Museum and Art Gallery. So we would have been a complete bust as Pictish warriors.
Yeah, well, if you know your stones, the Rhynie man is more us. He's kind of squat and short. Whereas you look at your guy, the Tulloch man, is kind of a big, tall, well-formed guy, I think.
A bit leggy kind. Now, I was thinking more in terms of they were brave, they're courageous, they were good on horseback, and they had a good head of hair.
Yeah, so
that's what kind of,
almost every count we're out.
That's it. Basically, we're busted. Anyway, earlier we heard Ewan and Catriona Reid waxing lyrical about the aspen, but effectively, back then, you just touched on it, essentially.
Yeah, there's just loads to know about this tree. The aspen. Of all the trees in Scotland, one of the most mysterious and magical in our countryside. It needs no seed to thrive, provides a gateway to the underworld, and has been severely punished by religion. In a Latin populus tremula, the trembling poplar, the shimmering leaves that twist and tremble in the slightest breeze, animating the autumn and filling the soundscape of the oncoming winter with a welcome rustle and whisper. In Greek, aspis, the shield. Indeed, the lightweight strength of the aspen wood was used as a physical shield in battle. But it's also a shield of much greater power, because the shield of aspen also gives the carrier the protection of magic. The powers of evil are impotent against the might of the aspen. Like the rowan, the trees were planted next to a home for protection. Treasure was buried in the roots of the tree to guard against theft. And a crown of aspen was laid in the tomb of the dead to allow their spirits to leave the underworld and return to be reborn. Indeed, the shaman of our ancestors would stand by the aspen in the wind and listen to the voices of those long gone and pass messages from the spirit world. Even to gaze on the trembling leaves twisting and turning in a gale can induce a mesmerising, trance-like effect, setting the mind free and spirit soaring. The Gaels of old would place a leaf of aspen under the tongue to aid eloquence, and a chance encounter with a fairy would often result in the gift of aspen to protect the family. Indeed, such was the respect and love of aspen that no fishing pole or farm implement could be made from its wood. Fears and apprehensions were banished by sap from the tree, and leaves were gathered by hand to feed livestock in times of need. A much loved and cherished tree, the aspen. But the aspen of today has a very different image from that of our ancestors long gone. The respect of the aspen was reversed by the arrival of Christian mythology. All things fairy became evil, all things pagan banned, and the poor shimmering aspen tree was said by priests to tremble in shame for having supplied the wood from which the cross of crucifixion was made, reducing the qualities of this beautiful tree to those of fear and loathing. A beautiful tree, an ancient tree, a tree which has woven itself into the very fabric of our heritage, the trembling beauty of the aspen.
It's a lovely sound, that, isn't it?
It's great. I just close your eyes and stand beside it and you can see how the shaman of old would say you're getting in touch with the underworld and passing messages.
Yeah. Just,
my neighbour, I do wonder about my neighbours, actually. Because...
Sorry, the gulls are crossing here for some reason.
Quite often they'll see me standing at the side of the road just with a microphone on my own.
He's doing it again.
Or in the middle of a field of barley in the wind.
Yeah, yeah. But that's a good sound too.
Yeah, as I was saying before, and say it often, we love hearing about where you listen to the programme. There's a couple got in touch from Tennessee.
This is cracking. It says, "Dear Mark and Ewan, our friends through the airwaves from rain-soaked Nashville, Tennessee. Many thanks for contributing to The Good Life. Every Saturday we roll out of bed saying, it's time to listen to the guys. Your broadcast is a much-anticipated weekly date. You paint for us an ever-growing canvas of the Scotland that enchanted us on holiday, anchoring us to places that deepen our outdoor-inspired loves. Your delightful personalities and voices brighten our day and get us moving." And that's Grant and Laurie Schlissner, or Schleissner, from Nashville.
What are you listening to?
Beats me. It must be John Beattie, I don't know.
Can't be us.
I wouldn't have thought so.
You've been up in Nairn as well, taking to the water.
Well,
again,
taking to the water, not as opposed to taking the Birken water. We've spoken dozens of times about the phenomenon of coastal rowing. This started off really quite small, and now it's huge.
It's Anstruther, was it?
I think. Well, originally it was Anstruther, yeah. Because it's a thing called the St. Ailes Skiff. It's a kit boat, and coastal communities have started building these things and rowing them in races. I think there's over 70
in Scotland. It's really taken off right round the coast.
Yeah, precisely. Now, Ardersier Boat Club had one. Nairn Boat Club had one. They combined, so effectively there's now one club up there with two boats. You'll hear why in a second. I dropped in past and tried to persuade them out onto the water.
If you just trim the boat by moving either side, if you just trim the boat to balance, because they're a wee bit imbalanced here. So we all right? Wait till you get the oars. They're kind of essential.
I'm Bill Wright. I'm the chairperson of the Nairn Coastal Rowing Club. About 18 months ago, we started getting things organised to get a club together because we saw that many of our local communities had a coastal rowing skiff and Nairn didn't, which is quite surprising considering the size of Nairn compared to some of the places that have skiffs.
You're feeling a bit left out there.
Well, no, I felt that there was an opportunity, to be honest, that there are people here who would probably appreciate it.
Can we just balance ourselves out?
Nearly all of them had no building experience before, you know, so it was very much a starting from scratch building the boat. We approached Ardersier, and Ardersier had Esther, their boat, which was not getting out very often because of weather conditions at the launch site in Ardersier. So we managed to get it up to Nairn, and actually by launching off the beach at Nairn and launching in the harbour at Nairn, we managed to not only get the Ardersier people out on the boat, but we also got quite a few of our own club members out as well.
Right, stand by. Stand by, ready, row. Together. Keep it together. Keep it together, Gil.
It's a 22-foot by 5-foot width boat. It was predominantly constructed from a kit. We took about 8.5 months to construct it. The colour is internally cream. The upper plank is a bright orange, and the lower three planks are a teal colour.
It's bright.
It's very bright. It's very bright.
Does it make it go any faster?
We'll find out in the next regatta. We'll find out in the next regatta. So, I think the colour's good in the sense of it's very visible when it's out there. Mm-hmm. So if we do have any issues, you know, it's very easy to see.
Stand by. We're going to come out to the harbour mouth. So hold water port. Keep rowing starboard. Not enough. Enough, Bob. Way enough. Right, starboard oars row.
How wide is this thing with the oars all out?
About 30 feet.
You haven't got a lot of room?
No. Pretty tight. I don't know what the depth's going to be like around here, so we'll just have to take it easy.
Quite a shallow mouth.
Okay, yeah. Right.
I will few, you see. We're just going to go down the channel here in a bit. Right, stand by. Right forward. And ready, roll.
I'm just looking across the side of the boat at the moment, and I can see the bottom of the river. There really isn't an awful lot of water. It should do for, hopefully. Doesn't come to a crunching halt.
My name's Elaine.
I'm Gail.
What's the ratio of male to female in this club?
Slightly more than half female than there is male. The males did a heck of a lot of the building. Not all males, but they did a heck of a lot of the building. But
there's a real good group of enthusiastic females wanting to go out rowing. There's a special feeling being out in the water, and unless you've been out there, you can't really describe what it's like. It's a feeling of being out in the freedom, fresh air. It can be peaceful. The wildlife is around you. I'm very lucky staying on the Murray Firth. I mean, we've got seals, we've got dolphins just out there in the Murray Firth. And, you know, that's just an extra added bonus, isn't it, when we catch some of that?
Yep, absolutely. For me, I just love being on the water. I've been part of the sailing club for a while, but when the coastal rowing came along, that was my thing. That's what I wanted to do. I wanted to be out there, you know, no sails flapping, no engines going, just splash and quiet and working as a team.
That's it. Good timing. Keep it long. In. Way enough.
In a long history of feeling like a spare wheel, it's been a long time since I've felt like such a spare wheel.
You're balancing the boat out.
Am I? Yeah. Well, thank God I'm doing something useful.
There's a mixture of people that just want to go out in the water and enjoy themselves. So yesterday, it was a beautiful day yesterday, and we tripped along to the old bar, which is just off the Nairn Harbour, about a mile away, and it was just beautiful. And I think a lot of people appreciate that. There's others that want to improve their technique and make the boat go faster and faster. And I think when we come to compete, which I think our first regatta is in May, I think people will start to get a bit more serious. But some people do it for fun, some people want to get fit. So there's a great mix, a huge mix in the club. Give me one stroke, stand by, one stroke. Enough.
Cox, Robbie Gordon there, and I'd also like to thank Bob Ferenth, Bill Wright, Elaine McPhail, Gail Duff and Greg Sparrow, all from the Nairn Coastal Rowing Club.
I love that sound effect of your knees.
You know, I should point out that the old bar they were referring to that they rowed down to is actually Sandbank.
Yeah, it's proper Sandbank, shifting sands of the old bar. Uh-huh. I've been... It's
close, very close.
I've thought about it, taking the boat in there, and then you look at a picture of it from above,
and you think, yeah.
And it's like the riddle of the sands. Just, you wouldn't go there with a barge boat.
I was out years ago with a friend of mine on his boat. He's got quite a big one. It's about 12 tons, this thing. It's been referred to as a floating half-timbered cottage.
It's quite a shallow draft boat.
Yeah, well, you'd be surprised. But it wasn't in its usual mooring. We were in I think it was Port Nocky Harbour, which is extremely tight in comparison with where it's normally kept. And I'd taken it out, and I was bringing it back in again, and I said, I don't think there's enough water in here. Yeah, I'll be fine, no problem. I said, no, seriously, this is your boat, your responsibility, you take over. 10 feet further on. And we sat there for another 6 hours, waiting to come back up again.
I went in there with my boat. This isn't a competition, but
no.
It draws quite a lot. And it's a beautiful, beautiful harbour.
Mm-hmm.
Tied up alongside, high tide. And a guy came down and said, I'm not trying to interfere, mate, but I wouldn't put your boat there. So I took his advice and put it outside the harbour. Sure enough, 4 hours later, it's just a sea of mud.
That's it.
And no water at
There's
all.
There's just nothing. Well, I've actually seen one somewhere. I'm trying to remember. It's a Liverpool, I think it was. Hanging.
Yeah.
Hanging, suspended, because it was moored so short.
Anyway, we digress.
As we usually do. Earlier, Ewan spoke to Catriona Reid, who's in charge of the Muiradhuna SNH Reserve near Aboyne, about aspen trees.
Yeah, but while we were there, Catriona casually joked from the conversation that adders were probably out sunning themselves in the spring warmth. Now, I've never seen an adder, ever. And I've always wanted to see one. So Catriona tromped off into the bracken, brimming with confidence.
We're going to go down to see if we can spot some adders. It's not ideal conditions for them because they aren't keen on the wind, they aren't keen on the cold, and they aren't keen on the rain. And right about now, it's doing all three
We've
of those.
Got all of that. I'm going to come clean here. I've done this job for 30 odd years. I've never seen an adder. Never.
Well, Muiradhuna is one of the best places to see. I mean, there are certain tips you can take with you whenever you go out in the countryside if you are specifically looking for adders. One is to watch your feet. They are beautifully camouflaged and you can often nearly tread on them by accident. And they do like lurking in amongst dead brackens, so they look very like dead brackens.
So how serious is a bite?
It varies. It varies hugely. They won't actually inject you with venom every single time they bite because they want you to back off. They can't poison you and eat you, so there's actually not really much point in them poisoning you if they can avoid it. But bites can be very serious. They can be fatal, but nobody's died of an adder bite for over 40 or 50 years.
Have you been bitten?
No, I would like to think I'm sensible and stay well back from them because it's all about respect, isn't it? If you see something like that, you can have a look at it, but with modern cameras, you can get so close to seeing things or with binoculars that you don't have to get too close to these things. And I never try and pick them up and touch them because, well, see, it's
just a stupid thing to do.
Yeah, it's a stupid thing to do, and it's about respecting the animal and its privacy and its space.
So you train to suck the venom out? He said, hopefully.
No, you certainly don't do that if you ever get bitten by a snake of any sort. All the stuff you see in cowboy films where people bleed themselves or suck venom out, it doesn't really work and is probably, if anything, liable to make things worse.
So what should you do?
If it gets bitten, you should immobilise the limb that's bitten and dial 999. So, yeah, as I was saying, you're out in the countryside and you're adders, you know, looking for adders. So you can't certainly keep an eye on your feet. But if you've got any sort of south-facing banks or dikes or walls, something with a bank behind it, and maybe a bit of overhead cover too, that's often a good place to try and keep an eye out for adders. Because it's south-facing, it's warm. A bit of overhead cover means predators won't spot the adders so much. Because though we think of adders as being very, very dangerous, there are actually plenty of things out there that will do damage to an adder.
What would take an adder?
Your very, very worst thing, you'll never guess, it's a pheasant.
Wow.
Pheasants are the worst. They're not predators of adders, but they kill them. It makes sense if you think about it. Pheasants are native to the UK. They were introduced from Asia. And they evolved in Asia. Now, out in Asia, there are some serious snakes. There are cobras, there are pythons. There's really dangerous stuff out there. So it makes sense these birds don't like snakes and they know how to deal with them. So they peck around the head, they can blind them, they can crush their skull, they'll stamp and scrape with the spurs and their feet. They really don't like adders and can possibly be one of the worst things for adders.
Okay, where are we going now? There's another one that
we'll follow the path down and round and we'll come at it from the bottom because if we walk down the hill we're less likely to see adders because we're more likely to scare them before we spot them. So we'll come at this from the bottom.
Okay, so do you think in the bracken?
I think in the bracken. I will, if you don't mind, walk slightly ahead of you for a moment.
Feel free.
And I'll see if I can spot any.
Well, you carry on. I'll wait here. Right, Katrina's actually wearing gaiters in case she does get bitten. And so am I. It's quite exciting. Just treading very carefully. You'd have to have a really good eye to spot one in this. So well camouflaged. Right, Katrina's just giving me a thumbs up, which I'm really excited. Never seen an adder. I'm going gently as well.
You walk along this grassy bit and then just look back round that lump there, you'll see it. It's a male. You walk Don't let your shadow fall on them if you can help it.
Oh, I can see him.
Got him?
Yeah, that's much blacker than I thought, with a very white tan markings.
Yeah, they vary hugely in colour, from almost pitch black to a very, very pale beige-brown colour, with always the black zigzag down their back.
So how long would that be?
Ooh, that's a good question.
It's quite well coiled up.
Yeah, they're longer than you think. I mean, that'll be certainly over a foot. That would probably be about 18 inches, I would think.
Oh, I can see the head now. I can see the tongue flicking.
I can see the tongue flicking. He's possibly scenting us. I would think we're downwind at the moment. We can speak fairly confidently, provided we don't start shouting. It's vibration from our feet, they'll feel. So you walk softly rather than walk normally.
So he probably knew we were coming.
He probably knew we were coming, but he's happy enough at the moment. If we stamped our feet, I suspect he'd disappear off into the bracken, because adders with their whole body on the ground work by vibration. So if something stamps, they feel that vibration, and that alerts them to whether something's coming close.
And if we're doing that deliberately, presumably we're breaking the law.
You're not actually. It's illegal to injure adders, but not to disturb them. Though, I mean, obviously it's morally unethical to do so. It's a shame, because people still do get a little bit freaked about snakes. And I suppose along with the red deer, they're one of the few bits of British wildlife that could actually do you some damage if they chose to.
I think he's seen us now. He's kind of stiffened up a bit.
Yeah, it could just be the wind. Sometimes they'll change position when there's a particularly cold gust of wind goes through, a bit like you and I sort of burn, shiver. He possibly has. It's our shadows we're mostly going to have to watch. We don't let fall on him. So
we shall leave him. I'm really impressed. Usually you turn up and you get, oh, you should have been here yesterday.
I've heard that myself plenty of times when I've been wildlife watching. Yeah.
There it is. One adder.
Yeah, there's possibly another one there, but I will check and see if I can spot that for you in a minute as well with my binoculars.
Yes, I'm happy with one. Thank you very much.
That's quite all right.
As you can tell, I was a happy wee boy.
Oh.
It was just great. And if you go to our Facebook page, you'll see not just the adder I saw then, because Katrina came up trumps. We've just moved about 6 feet and you've seen another one.
Yeah. Let's please spot the adder, shall we? You see that lone rock there?
Amongst the other 50 rocks.
Another 50 rocks. There's one isolated on its own, covered in moss amongst the bracken.
Up at 10 o'clock.
Yeah. And 10 o'clock from that, you'll see a sort of dark swirl in the bracken. Yeah. That's an adder there as well.
So do they all congregate together?
Yes and no. They're solitary animals for the most part, but at this time of year when they are fairly newly emerged from their winter hibernation, they often will congregate in an area close to where they've hibernated. Now, they've probably hibernated here. They could have been in old rabbit burrows and in amongst all these tumbled down rocks we can see round about us. And they're just staying close there. Part of the reason they're in here is it's sheltered. So this is a particularly warm spot. And for an animal that is cold-blooded, that is taking its heat from out the outside, the warmer the better. These guys will be really, really fast when they're warm, but they're pretty sluggish when they're cold, and they're therefore more vulnerable. So the warmer they are, the happier they are.
So where are the females?
The females aren't up yet. The girl's like a lion of a year. The females don't tend to get up till April time, and once they emerge, you'll start seeing changes in the males. You'll start seeing the eye going cloudy, which is a sign they're going to be shedding their skins fairly soon. And once they shed their skins, they're ready to mate with the females. And they'll change colour. I mean, that one we're looking at there looks pretty dark brown and black. He could be quite a, guessing by looking at his face, a vivid bluey grey kind of colour, much like the lichens you're seeing on the tree, with a very definite black zigzag down.
So, what about the dance?
The dance of the adders is two rival males having a fight, quite honestly, to see who gets the right to mate with a female. You'll often get a female emerge, and once the males are shed and the female is receptive, a male will guard her so he can mate with her and maybe mate with her more than once. However, when more males will send her out, come in about, and if two of these males are of a similar sort of size, they'll need to fight it out to decide who's going to have the right to guard or mate with this female. Now, because adders are poisonous, they don't bite each other. There's a bit of a, you're not hiding to nothing if you bite something and you're poisonous, because it bites you back and then you both die. There's really
professional respect.
Yeah, there's really not much sense in trying doing it like that. So they wrestle, and the dance of the adders is when they both rise off the ground, and twine in amongst each other and wrestle and try to push the other one down and exert their dominance. It's very, very fast and very, very graceful. I've only seen it a few times. And it can go on for quite a few minutes if the males are evenly matched. Sometimes you can see right away which one is going to win, and you often get the feeling the smaller one's just sort of doing it out of pride. But they can be very evenly matched, and they will wrestle, I say, for minutes at a time to decide who gets the female.
Catriona Reid and the adders at the Muir of Dinn at Nature Reserve. I would like to see the adders dance.
Yeah, I would love to see that as well. We've got to put some of Catriona's pictures up on our Facebook page, and you just see that beautiful movement. Mm-hmm. And lovely wee things.
Last time I saw them was on Invermark Estate up Glen Esk, and they were just beside the side of the road, and it was the males that come out sunning itself on a rock. You know, we're moving forward very, very slowly, very, very carefully, trying not to make any noise, checking that the wind was in the right direction and things. And we got really quite close to it, and it's seen that little tongue flick out. Beautiful wee things.
Yeah, I'll tell you one tale about that. We were in Montana filming, and I was out the back of the truck changing my gear to get the television kit on. I went back in the car and David...
Yeah, cowboy hat.
Yeah, cowboy hat. I'm all shooting in cowboy boots, as far as I remember. Why not? I went back in the car, and David Williamson, the cameraman, went out to relieve himself.
Yes.
And suddenly he discovered he'd relieved himself upon a rattlesnake.
Ah.
Which launched itself at him. I've never seen a cameraman move so quickly.
He'll move quite fast under those circumstances. Self-preservation's a wonderful thing. Sadly, that's all we've got time for in this week's Scotland Outdoors podcast. Join us again for another one if you can. But until then, from all of the team here at BBC Aberdeen, thanks for listening.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.